The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Backchat. If the Nature Podcast is a well-managed and tranquil aquarium, then Backchat is feeding time at the zoo. Our menagerie of topics this month includes predatory journals, the prognosis for coral, and a rare species called a time crystal. And no, most reporters who covered that didn't know what it was either. I'm Kerry Smith, and here are my three rare and exotic fauna.
Hello, Kerry. I'm Lizzie Gibney. I am a reporter here in London. I cover physics and astronomy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Daniel Cressy. I'm another reporter here in London.
And I'm Manya Baker. I'm an editor in San Francisco.
Lovely. Thanks, everyone. Now, coming up in the show, nice work if you can fake it. A completely made-up scientist gets given editing positions at a rather long list of journals with questionable acceptance standards. The Great Barrier Reef is in peril, bleaching for the second year in a row due to warmer ocean temperatures. So what is in its future? And at the end of the show, we get familiar with time crystals, just one of the many scientific phrases that sound cooler to the average person than perhaps they actually are. Now, firstly, Monia, to you and the results of a sting operation that you're publishing this week.
Well, it started with four researchers at the University of Wrocław in Poland. They were getting annoyed by all these invitations they were getting from journals that had nothing to do with their field of research. So a predatory journal is a journal that does not care about quality and is publishing articles just to collect fees from authors. They don't provide peer review or other quality assurances that they say they do. So these authors decided that they were going to try to catch the predators out. They made up a scientist. Her name is Anna Osust, and that means Anna of Fraud in Polish. They made up her CV. They made her fairly unqualified to be an editor at a journal, and then they popped off an email requesting an editor position at 360 journals. 120 had been named as predators by a librarian in Colorado, and the rest were on two different kinds of white lists that had been vetted for quality. The responses were incredible. 40 alleged predatory journals wrote back, often fairly quickly, accepting this fake applicant and then asking her to collect papers and sometimes offering to split the revenues that the fake editor brought in.
How generous of them. I mean, she was, when you say she was fairly unqualified, I don't think her CV that they'd made up for her had any peer-reviewed papers on it at all, did it?
It had some book chapters, but it did not have peer-reviewed articles. She signed her name as having a degree that in her letter she said she was working towards. So there was a contradiction right from the start.
And when you read the results that they sent to you and that you're publishing in a comment article this week, I mean, were you surprised to find how many journals had just kind of unequivocally said yes to her?
I wasn't as surprised that so many said yes, but I was surprised at just how mercenary the replies were. One of the replies says, "Please send the following details to Western Union."
Wow.
So they were both trying to collect money directly from the applicant and also asking the applicant to pull in articles from her friends and colleagues that for which they would pay publication fees.
And how big is the danger from journals like this? Because even into our own email inboxes here, I'm sure you guys get as many as I do of these sort of like, please send me your articles for the proceedings of the whatever it is, international insert made up meeting here. I mean, it's obvious that there's spam, isn't it?
Well, I think it's obvious that it's spam, but I think it's not obvious to everyone. I also think that there are plenty of authors who submit to predatory journals knowing exactly what they're doing. They simply want to be able to say that they've gotten a publication.
This is one of the questions I always have with these journals, because it seems like some of them are so obviously not legitimate that the vast majority of people who submit papers there must know what they're getting. There was another study that was done recently by a team who looked at the kind of different factors that seem to link predatory and non-predatory journals. And they found that the average publication fee in what they listed as a predatory journal was about $100, whereas the average open access publication fee was $1,800. I mean, if this was a shop and you walked in and or you were looking on the internet and one company that like had spelling mistakes all over its website said they could do you something for a fiver and another one said it was going to cost you 50 quid or 100 quid, like, you'd know what was going on there.
Either way, it's a bit of a scourge, though, isn't it?
That's it. And what can we do about it? Like, I wonder what kind of an impact this sting will have, because now it's been charted in a kind of systematic and thorough way. I mean, but I don't know. Can you go to some length to shut them down? Or
I think that what will shut them down will be if researchers are no longer rewarded by the number of entries on their CVs. I think that if the reviewing committees, the tenure committees, the promotion committees that are giving researchers credit actually look at the quality of the papers themselves rather than counting them.
I think we should go further. Instead of just dismissing these articles from people's applications, we should be actively penalising people. I mean, unless they can demonstrate that they really were scammed by a journal. Because these are the people trying to cheat the system in a large number of cases.
Yeah, I've heard that idea before, and it gets really tough because there's no authoritative list of what is a predator. The librarian in Colorado, his list was very controversial. It was something that he did on his own initiative, and some people questioned some of the titles that were listed on there. And he's recently taken it down because of what many people assume are legal threats. He's not saying.
It's interesting that it existed in the first place, as you say, because of all the threats you'd think he would be party to. And indeed, I think he was threatened with a $1 billion lawsuit at one point, right, Monya?
Well, the authors sent out emails to everybody who had accepted Dr. Fraud. And among the replies that they got was an email saying that from somebody who had a lawyer's name but came from a non-professional email address saying that law firm was responsible for getting Beale's list taken down because he had been sued for $1 billion.
But I don't think we actually know why Beale's list was taken down yet. I think that's still...
Yeah, that's still up for discussion, I think.
Yeah, there's no official word that I'm aware of.
Has the popularity and the prevalence of open access journals kind of enabled these other predatory journals to exist? Because after all, that's the model, isn't it? The author pays to have their submission published.
The fact that the author is paying is what allows these predatory journals to exist. So you have the open access model where nobody pays to read an article. Instead, the author pays usually to have it published.
I just want to say that in some cases, that's another issue here, which we should be considering, that this is, in a lot of cases, this may be public money that's being spent. These are government research grants, government-funded researchers. And that money is taxpayers' money, and it's going to these completely junk journals. And we expect scientists to keep to such high standards in so much of their work and jump through so many hoops to get approval for their experiments and to get their grants and to do all the work, the brilliant work that they do. And yet right at the end, they're saying, OK, yeah, fine, go off, publish it wherever you like.
And it's not just the money that goes into the publication fees that's being lost. It's the money that's going into the research, assuming that the research was actually done. And because a lot of the predatory journals aren't indexed, you could not find once that article is, quote unquote, published, other people won't be able to find it.
One thing I loved about this, Monia, is where you give the responses from some of the more responsible journals, where they very kindly reply and say things like, well, we probably won't have you as an editor on our board, but you might start with actually publishing some papers and then maybe reviewing some papers. And then eventually, this is where you may end up. I thought that was lovely.
I read all of the email correspondence, and for some of the quality journals, people there really took some time to try to guide an early career researcher who did not seem to have a lot of experience or sophistication about how to build her career. It was such a contrast to the people who were simply asking Dr. Fraud to collect papers and income. Even a cursory inspection is not necessarily happening.
As an aside, Dr. Fraud is a great supervillain name.
Yeah.
There should totally be a sequel or a spin-off comic book featuring Dr. Fraud.
Professor Cursory Inspection versus Dr. Fraud. Having dealt then with one ecosystem, including the predators we've just discussed, let's move on to a very different type of ecosystem in rather poor health, Dan. The Great Barrier Reef has been in the news, not for extremely happy reasons.
Yeah, the Great Barrier Reef has been on the cover of Nature in recent weeks and also all over just about every other newspaper in the world. And the reason for this is the coral bleaching that is occurring there and also occurred there last year.
And this, for those of us who don't know too much about bleaching, why it happens and how frequent it is, people are very worried about this.
Yeah, so corals bleach basically when the water gets too hot. They expel these symbiotic algae that live inside them, and that is pretty bad for their health. If the bleaching is very bad, those corals can actually die, and then the reef is obviously affected by that because they're quite important species. Before recent times, there were two kind of historical bleaching events known on the Barrier Reef, and then last year there was a very, very big bleaching event that a lot of people were very worried about. The paper that Nature put out this month analyzes these three past bleaching events, and what it shows is that the pattern of the bleaching correlates very well with basically how hot the water temperature is. And one of the sort of important conclusions to draw from this is that you can't really locally manage bleaching events very well, because the real problem is that the sea is getting warmer. And if we don't do something about global warming, well, these coral reefs are going to be in serious trouble.
It's the same, isn't it, with a lot of these kind of symbols of climate change. I'm thinking of like polar bear standing on melting iceberg. And now we have here this big symbol of something that's kind of unconquerably difficult.
It's also a huge and complex system, and we have to be careful not to overstate it. There's been a lot of disquiet amongst coral researchers about stories that say the Barrier Reef is dead, or even in some cases the Barrier Reef is dying. I mean, the reef is a huge, complex ecosystem. There are lots of individual corals that are now dead as a result of these bleaching events. But some of the scientists who've done the most work there are very, very adamant that we shouldn't give up on it as a system. We shouldn't think of it as dead, and we shouldn't start writing its obituary as one media source did last year.
So can the areas where there has been a bleaching event recover? And how often does that happen, and under what conditions?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's one of these questions where there's no simple answer. Like, corals can recover from bleaching events, or they can die, and that depends on the severity of the event, which again in some cases is linked to how hot the water actually gets. And even if the coral dies, that doesn't mean that everything there is dead. I mean, those corals can in some cases be reseeded with other corals, new species can grow there. But one of the concerns is that corals grow very slowly. So if your corals die off, something that grows a lot faster but is maybe a lot less useful to the ecosystem can move in pretty quickly, and you could just get like an overgrowth of some sort of horrible algae that you don't really want.
I know forestry researchers are trying to do migration for trees. So they're actually physically moving trees that are adapted to grow in warmer areas to places that are newly become warm. Is there any possibility for that kind of remediation?
Yeah, coral restoration is something that there's a lot of interest in and that a lot of people are trying. The issue, though, is that the size of these reefs in a lot of cases, when you look at the Barrier Reef, it stretches up a huge swathe of the Australian coast. And you can maybe grow some coral elsewhere and reseed small parts of that. But I think no one is seriously considering fixing the bleaching of the scale that we've seen on the Barrier Reef last year, for example. I mean, you're looking at hundreds of individual reefs over hundreds of kilometres.
Have you been frustrated by what you've seen in the media as the characterisation of the of this event? Like, have lots of people been using the word dead, the word dying, when really they shouldn't have been?
It's certainly problematic. There's a real tendency to say the reef is dying, and to say the reef as if it's like one thing, and it's dying as if it's definitely happening. So, yeah, it's easy to kind of spin this the wrong way or to not caveat it properly.
Speaking of spin, speaking of mischaracterising things, speaking of scientific topics, which the media love and have been putting everywhere, time for time crystals.
Yay,
Lizzie, I'm so
favorite.
Glad you're here to explain what on earth a time crystal is.
Yeah, so this one was a lot of fun. The issue with this story is that time crystals are a super cool notion in theory. But the kind of time crystal that has actually been experimentally realized is not the kind that was initially imagined and that everybody gets more easily in their head. So the general notion of a time crystal is something that repeats, it does in time what many things do in space already. So you imagine a normal crystal, like a salt, you have a lattice, and it has this periodicity to it, and its atoms all find fixed places. So you can imagine that instead of doing that in space, you had something that did it in time. So it cycles in some way, coming back to its original configuration. And the idea is that, like a crystal, it would be in its lowest energy state, its ground state. That would be something really weird, right? Because imagine it couldn't have any lower energy, and yet there's some kind of cyclic process happening within it.
So it's kind of generating energy from somewhere.
Well, exactly. That's what it sounds like it's doing, which is clearly mad, and that's what everybody thought when Frank Wilczek proposed it in 2012. Well, they thought it was mad, but also kind of brilliant, because it's not that crazy, given that lots of strange things happen in the quantum world. You actually have superconductors, which in theory would forever conduct electricity, right? So that can kind of be thought of as some kind of perpetual motion.
So all of these implications, fascinating as they are, this prediction that was theoretical, that would have been great, wouldn't it, if that was the news?
It would have been absolutely fantastic. My story would have been so easy to write.
It wasn't the news, was it?
It was not the news. So the news is we have made time crystals, yay, but they are really quite different from that original kind of time crystal. Now, mathematically, they fit all the criteria, and to a physicist, they're totally fine with this being a time crystal. So they don't completely spontaneously come up with their own with a periodicity out of nothing. But what they do is have a period that doesn't match the regularity with which they are being kicked or pushed in some way. You have like a driving force. But okay, so this is not cool in the way we originally thought, but it's cool in a completely different way. This happens in out of equilibrium systems. They are constantly evolving and changing and aren't in a steady state. And yet they somehow have this stability in that they go through this regular cycling.
I can tell how excited you are by this, and using you as a proxy for the physics community, I can tell that they were probably pretty excited by this not quite an original time crystal idea. You know, it kind of surprised me to see it reported, though, so widely by the mainstream press, who bravely took it on and actually do a good job of reporting difficult things like, you know, the Higgs boson, for instance. But where did people trip up?
I was quite pleased to see, actually, there was only maybe one, maybe two that just completely ignored the fact that it wasn't the original kind of time crystal. There are some that did that. The rest, we had some great analogies as well, when this idea that it responds with a periodicity that doesn't match the periodicity with which it's being driven produced some great analogies. So the one that I used in my story, which came from one of the authors of the paper and ended up actually being quite ubiquitous because I guess lots of people spoke to him, is about using, you have people playing with a skipping rope. And in the Wilczek example, it would be like the skipping rope just starts swinging around all by itself. In this example, it would be that you have to use your arm and rotate it twice for you to actually get the rope to go around once. Other people tried to describe it by saying it's like hitting a piano key twice, but just getting one note. And there was one about zorbing, which, because I've done all the research on this, I know, and it's actually really good. It's a very good description, but I am really not convinced that the everyday reader would have got it. It's about, like, imagine you've got loads of Zorbs, you know, those big balls that you...
the clear you plastic human-sized balls,
exactly.
And you run inside them like guinea pigs,
exactly,
basically.
And maybe, like, tumble down a hill. And the idea, it was kind of talking about if you put a big spot on it and then you watch what happens to the spots. And it's trying to introduce the idea of the systems in which this actually works. So you have a driving force, you also need interactions between them, and you also need an element of random disorder.
Skipping rope I found helpful. The piano keys, I mean, mind-blowing, but still I get the idea. And the one with the Zorbs, frankly, I just couldn't, you know, keep head or tail of it. I mean, these neon blobs going around on Zorbs, and then the rest of the Time Crystal story just fell out of my head. I couldn't quite cope with that.
Can we go right back to the beginning? A time crystal, is it a physical thing, and what is it actually made out of?
Okay, so yes, it's a physical thing, that it's made out of two different systems in this case. So one is ytterbium, I hope I said that right, ytterbium atoms, and there are a string of 10 of them. So it's not a physical movement. What's happening is it's the flipping of the spins of these atoms that is showing the periodicity. So you zap it with a laser twice to get it back to the beginning. And the other system is also spins, but not of not in the same way. It's in little defects within diamond. And a bit flippantly, several of the researchers I spoke to for this story said, yeah, it doesn't entirely make sense that it works in that system. But we're just going to gloss over that a little bit.
So much glossing. So much glossing in this story. Is there a story that you've done more glossing for than this, do you think?
I mean, in every quantum mechanics story, you have to just... You often end up saying, because quantum weirdness. And everyone goes, oh, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? So that's fine.
And Davide, I think, has the same when he covers maths for us.
Yeah.
That, then he goes, because topology.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, oh, that's fine.
They just need to go, think of a donut or a bagel.
And then everyone's hungry and then you're off topic.
I actually love... There's a kind of particular subtype of British humour that just relies on awkwardness. And I love when I ask someone a question or I try out an analogy on them. Is it a bit like... And then it just falls complete. They don't know what to say. Just
quite often they say, yeah, it's a bit more like... And then they go on to say something completely different. And you're like, oh, that's sweet. So mine was completely wrong.
Earlier today, I tried out an analogy that involved the crown jewels and the architecture that's been built around the crown jewels in order to get people in and allow them to have the transformative experience of looking at the crown jewels and then leaving the building. And I can't even remember where I was going with that. And the guy on the other end of the phone just said... I mean, it's basically, okay, I just need to go now.
So I'm still really confused. I mean, if you have a three-dimensional, the reason they're called crystals is because they repeat regularly, and that's what three-dimensional crystals do.
And the rigidity part of it, the fact that they are, they have this kind of set periodicity that you can't easily change.
Okay. And so, like, for three-dimensional crystals, you have to have a certain number of particles to get the repeating patterns. Is that also analogous?
Well, in time, the equivalent would be there saying you need it to last a particular length of time, which I guess is true. I mean, if you did it once, probably that wouldn't really mean anything. You need to, in this case, I think they did 100 cycles.
This conversation is the exact reason why most reporters just put their caps lock on and wrote, "Time crystals, zorbing," and then went home.
So... I'm just thinking, like, the Hope Diamond, right? That's a really, really exciting because it's sort of a big crystal. And so now are we going to get really long crystals? Like, this crystal lasted 3 hours or...
Yeah, that would be really cool. I mean, to me.
Are there any other terms, just out of interest, that you guys know that are more exciting than the reality of them? I don't know. One of mine would actually be...
Sorry.
How dare you, Dr. Fraud? What are you doing here? Okay, point taken. Okay, well, thank you to Lizzie Gibney and Dan Cressy here in London and Monia Baker in San Francisco. You can find more of their work and the rest of the Nature magazine team's work at nature.com/news and find more audio updates on science from us at nature.com/nature/podcast. If you have thoughts about anything you've heard on the show, do drop us a line on Twitter at naturepodcast or at naturenews or by email podcast@nature.com. That is enough ats for the time being. You can also vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. There's a listener choice category, and we'd be thrilled if you chose us. Go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, search for Nature, and enter your name. I'm Kerry Smith, and thanks to you all for listening.
Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. from the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.